Okay, here we go. All right, I'm Jonathan Sadon, the pastor of Grace Church in Dover, Delaware. I've been there since 1979. That's 32 years, which is hard for me to believe. I came there. It was a white upper middle class church. I'm Latino and a missionary kid, but totally enculturated American. So I can easily move in these circles. The church grew, and it wasn't until 1996 that the Lord began to do a work in my heart. It would take a while to tell that story, but I just want to point out that I had been there for some quite number of years before I even began to think about the issues of racial reconciliation. And just for the sake of time here, I want to just say that I'm going to equate reconciliation in the church with becoming multi-ethnic. I know there's more to reconciliation than that, but what I want to talk about is our own history, and I hope to be able to draw some helpful ideas from my own story. There are a lot of books. There's a lot of places you can learn on how to become a multi-ethnic church. The second thing that I want to do is I want to make a distinction, and this is for the sake of our denomination, and that is that I make a distinction between between our church having multi-ethnic churches and having multiple ethnic churches. All right? There's a difference between multi-ethnic and multiple ethnic. Multiple ethnic is what we have to some degree. That is to say, we have Latino churches, we have Korean churches, we have black churches, we have white churches. Those are not multi-ethnic churches. Multi-ethnic church is a church in which people of multiple ethnic backgrounds are together and worship together, share leadership, and serve side by side. So that's what I mean. I also want to speak, since we're here and we're in this particular point in the PCA, I want to say that I don't think that we can plant multi-ethnic churches fast enough to redirect the PCA. Even if MNA were to restrict all church plants to being multi-ethnic, which I would do, but even if they were to do that, you still couldn't plant them fast enough. I think what has to happen, and this is my passion, is for existing mono-ethnic churches to embrace the vision of becoming multi-ethnic. And so that's what I want to, that's kind of where I'm coming from. That's my history. That's my passion. And in the interest of time, let me just mention that in our church, we have two Anglo pastors, Rick and Jeff. We have an African-American pastor, Kenny Foster. We have a Latino pastor, soy yo, and moi. All right. And we are in the process of hiring a Korean pastor to be a part of our staff and to reach into the Korean community. So there's all kinds of cool stuff happening, which the Lord is doing. I mean, I'm just watching and saying and being amazed at what the Lord is doing, and so I'm thankful to Him. All right, what are some practical steps? First of all, we're talking about it over here. I believe that in order for a mono-ethnic church to become a multi-ethnic church, the leader, the senior pastor, has to own the vision. Jeff Rakes and I went to Mexico for 7 years and did worship conferences, and we would have the worship leaders come. They would learn all kinds of new ideas, go back to their churches, and they got squashed because the leadership wasn't about it. So the same thing can happen. The leader, the pastor, needs to own the vision. And furthermore, the vision that he holds, he must believe that it is non-negotiable and that it is a biblical imperative. That is to say, it's not one vision among many. It's not one that you can choose or not choose. It is the vision, and it is the vision of God. Revelation 5 and 7 is the vision. A vision is a picture of a preferable future. And so that vision is something that you are pushing toward and seeking to attain. So the vision is non-negotiable. It is imperative. Furthermore, I would argue, and this is part of what has to be embraced, and that is that racial reconciliation is at the very heart of the gospel. That this issue is not a matter of being politically correct. It's not a matter of demographic change around your community. There's a lot of churches where the community changes around them, and all of a sudden it's either change or die, and there are a lot of white churches that have literally died because they haven't changed, right? It's not because by 2050, the United States is going to become a minority nation in which whites are going to be for the first time be a minority. It isn't because we look at the nations that are coming and somehow if we don't change, we're going to die and become and get pushed to the periphery and be marginalized. Those are not compelling enough reasons. The only thing that is compelling enough and that will sustain you, the only thing that has sustained me in pressing on and on in the face of difficulty and adversity and disappointment and discouragement is this is the biblical vision. I must do this because this is what the Bible actually teaches. The mystery of the gospel. I think that Ephesians is the central text for the multi-ethnic church. We know that it's in there in the third and fourth chapters. But the thing that really caught my attention some years ago was Paul's argument, his request for prayer at the end of Ephesians, where he asked that he will be given courage in order that he may declare the mystery of the gospel for which he's in chains. And I had never really looked at that sufficiently to recognize that Paul was not in prison for preaching the gospel. It wasn't because he was preaching salvation through faith alone. It wasn't because he was preaching that Jesus was Lord as opposed to Caesar. All you have to do is go back to the account in Acts 21 through 22, and there you will see that he was put in prison because he was teaching Gentile inclusion. The Jews that listened to him, they were ready to listen to him until he said that he had been sent to the Gentiles. At that point, they said, this man is not worthy of life. They prepared to kill him. And only Roman imprisonment at that point saved him from those who were ready to take his life. Racial reconciliation is at the heart of the gospel. I would also argue that New Testament Gentile inclusion is the archetype for all inclusion. So I grew up as a Pentecostal, dispensationalist, all of that. All right? I became Reformed. I embraced covenant theology. Any time I saw the teachings about Gentile inclusion, the only thing I could think about was covenant theology, infant baptism, right? It was always this theological framework. But the fact of the matter is that covenant theology, this idea of Gentile inclusion, is actually at the heart of all racial reconciliation, and it is the theological foundation for the multi-ethnic church. The irony is that we Presbyterians aren't leading the way. We actually have the theology. It is because we have faith, because we are all children of Abraham, regardless of our background, that we are all sons and daughters. We are heirs and co-heirs with the Jews and all of the blessings of the Abrahamic covenant. Racial reconciliation, and I'm just racing through this, racial reconciliation must be lived out in community. Some of these things we've been talking about, but these are the things that I'm arguing that the pastor, the leader, must embrace and hold these things to be true. Racial reconciliation is to be lived out in community, that is to say, in the local church. I haven't got time now, but after Paul talks all through chapter 3 of Ephesians, when he comes to chapter 4, he says, therefore, live in a way that is in accordance with your calling. What is the calling? Well, he's just been laying it out for the last two chapters. And so these teachings about living in love, well, let me just go there real quick. All right. I'm going to go to two passages because I just think that this is very crucial. Because in chapter 2 and 3 is where he's been teaching about breaking down the walls of division, of division and hostility. And then he says, as a prisoner for the Lord, then, because of all of this, I urge you to live a life worthy of the calling you have received. Be completely humble, gentle, patient, bearing with one another in love. Make every effort to keep the unity of the Spirit through the bond of peace. There is one body. That's not a passage that we should take in isolation and say that's how we ought to live in a particular church. He's talking about a church in which people from racial backgrounds in which they hated one another and which there was division are now to live this way. That's why that is so radical. The same thing is true over in Colossians, the third chapter. We're familiar with verse 11. Here there is no Greek or Jew, circumcised or uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave or free, but Christ is all and in all. Therefore, Here it is. As God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourselves with compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience. There's a context to it. And the context to living that way and living in love is the fact that there's a church in which there are Greeks and Jews, there are circumcised and uncircumcised, there are barbarians, there are Scythians, there are slaves, they're free, but they see and know that Christ, they are all one in Christ. All right. Next thing I would say is that, and we've already hinted, it's been spoken to, and that is that the model church of the New Testament is Antioch, not Jerusalem. Jerusalem had to be persecuted in order for it to do what God told them to do, right? Antioch is the first place where the followers of Jesus are called Christians. It's the first place in where there is an intentional going across the lines of race in order to extend the gospel. Maybe you've never noticed this before, but let me just go there also very quickly. Where we read these words. Here's the persecution. Verse 19 of chapter 11. Now those who had been scattered by the persecution in connection with Stephen traveled as far as Phoenicia, Cyprus, and Antioch, telling the message only to the Jews. All right? These are the... Some, however, men from Cyprus and Cyrene went to Antioch and began to speak to Greeks also. Whoa! There it is. And what do you have? You have the Antioch church. And if you go to chapter 13, the first few verses, you see that they have a diverse, multi-ethnic leadership team. And this is the Antioch church, is the church where the missionary journeys go out. This is where the church planting work of the New Testament finds its hub and its center. All right, 8 minutes. And I'm just reiterating, only if the leader believes the vision to be non-negotiable will he have the motivation, the passion to press forward against pushback. And there will be pushback. I was sitting at a table just here just recently talking about a white church. And the question is, how can it become multi-ethnic? I'm just saying the leader has to lead. And eventually all the leaders have to be brought on board. And that's where I'm heading in just a minute. Next. I would argue that in order to become a multi-ethnic church, you need to embrace a parish model of ministry and eschew the homogeneous unit principle of church growth. A curse on that principle. Oh, let me tell you, the PCA, if every church in the PCA simply decided to adopt a parish model of ministry... existing churches, just put the center of your compass where your church is, and then you decide what the radius, how big that radius is going to be to determine. If you're in a city, the radius is going to be pretty short. If you live in the country, it's going to be pretty big. But you just draw a circle, and you call that your radius, and within that group, within that parish, you will find people of a lot of different ethnic backgrounds, and unless you're in the farmlands, right, somewhere in Ohio or Western New York or something. But even there, you will find, you know, hired hands and the landowners. And so you will still be crossing across the lines of race and class, education, all sorts of things. So you'll just do it. And so I would argue that we need to embrace that in order to become a multi-ethnic church, you need to embrace a parish model. Do a demographic study of your parish. Let me tell you right now, this is what broke the logjam. A better leader than I would have gotten our church down the road farther, faster than I have. So take heart, right? If the Lord can use me to do this, any of you can succeed. But one of the things that happened in our church was that in dealing with the leadership, with the elders of our church, it was always this theological argument. It was always all this pushback, and it finally dawned on me. How about this for a simple idea? I said to the side, what if we were to just try to reach the people in our neighborhood? Can you argue with that? No. So I said, well, let's do this. Let's draw a circle with a radius 1 mile, and then let's do another one with 2 miles out. A donut hole and a donut, right? And let's find out who's there. So I call up M&A. I say, you know, you guys, I had never done this before. So, those demographics? Yeah, they gave me all the information. We did the demographic study. What we found was 39% of the community around was in both of those areas, 39% was African American. We had no African Americans in our church. Hello, right? So, and that was actually what broke the logjam on our session. Because they could, how do you argue against trying to reach the people that are in your own Jerusalem, right? I mean, they're right here. And that was really, frankly, that was the thing that really that broke it loose. Okay, embrace a parish model. Choose a radius, do a demographic study, find leadership that represents the people in your parish. Now that you know who's there, they're more likely to come if they see people like themselves in their, especially in leadership. And I would say, and this is hard to do in the PCA, how many African American pastors are there actually in the PCA now? Are we up to 50 yet, or how many? 51. Out of how many ordained ministers are there in the PCA? Almost 6,000. Yeah, I think it's like 5,600. How many? It is a big number. Somebody figure that out. All right. Yeah, it is a big number. Whoa, there goes my iPhone. Well, I don't know, but it's a lot. I think that's right. No, I'm going to find out. So here it is. Model inclusion at the highest level of leadership. The reason I say this is hard is because we decided, you know what? What we need to do is we need to bring an African-American on our pastoral staff. You know how hard it is to find an African-American in the PCA? I came to Covenant Seminary, and I heard about Tony Miles. And I said, all right, you know. Tony Miles was our first effort, you know. So I went and I started talking to some of the seminary professors. They said, get in line. Yeah. We brought Tony, you know, he came to Dover. And we still love Tony, but he turned us down, you know. That's all right. Oh, yeah. So, yes. Well, the Lord in His grace and His kindness just enabled us to steal Kenny Foster from New City Fellowship in Chattanooga. And what an incredible addition. And so for us, but I'm telling you, when we brought Kenny on board, he preaches as much as I do. We absolutely split the preaching in our church. Now, if you're already the pastor of a church and you bring someone in like that, let me tell you, you can say, I don't care what you say, you will feel it. Right? When Kenny is preaching and people all surround him after the service, right? I'm just talking like a preacher here, right? You all know what I'm talking about. When they call him up and they want him to do the wedding. When they want him to do the funeral. Are you hearing me? This is an issue of real leadership, real power. May we call it power? If you're not willing to surrender power, if you're not willing to become less so that the other can become more, if you're not willing to do that, it ain't going to happen. Last point, and I have 1 minute and 10 seconds. Okay. Well, let me make a parenthetical remark here. Serve your community. We're doing Jobs for Life, Faith and Finances, all those. That is a huge way to reach our community. So, but let me just say this, in conclusion, and this was what was really hard to achieve in our church, and we finally got there. But it is this: all leaders and their spouses must embrace the vision. That is, they must be for the vision, not merely unopposed. All the leaders. Here is the policy statement for Grace Church. In order to achieve the vision of GPC, the staff and officers of GPC, along with their wives, we also mean our secretaries and their spouses, must be united in mind and heart regarding the vision. They must be committed to pursuing and modeling the vision, regardless of any opposition that may arise, and be prepared to the best of their ability to articulate the biblical foundation of the vision. Tap. All right. They must be committed to pursuing and modeling the vision, regardless of any opposition that may arise, and be prepared to the best of their ability to articulate the biblical foundation of the vision and defend it within the congregation. Leaders of the church, staff, and officers, together with their wives, must be for the vision and not merely unopposed to it. And the last point that I had was preach, teach the vision, always use it all the time. So, all right. I have these. Actually, all of that was kind of written out in your thing, and then I have some discussion questions there for you. All right.
Amen. So take some time on those questions.